Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of Wander Studios podcast. Today we have Mike Townsend dialing in from Austin, Texas. Mike is currently the director of product design at Order, where he is building a creative and research team to scale and manage UX, UXR, and marketing design practices. Mike has over 20 years of experience as a designer, specifically focused on user experience and UX research, and has worked with companies like Amazon, American Airlines, Charles Schwab, Experian, HP, Lowe's, Mercedes, and Pepsi, just to name a few. That's a mouthful. He has also helped scale design practice at The Knot as the Senior Director of Product Design. And when he can, he also teaches design part-time and mentors designers. Mike, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Thank you so much for having me. And I'm doing fantastic. Happy to be here.
Awesome. I'm actually really excited to be recording this episode. Mike and I had met before when he was applying for a position at Wander a handful of years ago. And we ended up not filling that seat, but I love the fact that the universe has brought us back together to see what you've been up to and that the audience can learn from your experience as a design leader. So every episode, we start off with rapid fire round. Mike, are you ready for this?
Let's do it. Let's rapid fire it.
Awesome. So where did you grow up?
So I grew up in a town called McKinney, Texas, which is about 35 miles north of Dallas.
McKinney, Texas. Yeah. All right. And where are you now?
I'm in Austin, Texas, the home of Matthew McConaughey and breakfast tacos. Very, very happy being down here.
Breakfast tacos. I don't think I've had any one of those before. It sounds yummy though.
Oh my gosh. Next time you come down to Austin, Jenny, we're going to have breakfast tacos. It's like, why would you want to have anything else for breakfast? I don't understand.
Breakfast of Champions.
That's right.
What's a book that you think everyone should read?
Yeah, this is a hard question to answer. I think the book that I always recommend people that is a read that I make about once a year is Turn the Ship Around by L. David Marquette. It was the book that really helped me formulate my plan for being a design leader and just a leader in general. And I try to pawn it off on somebody every chance I get to hope that they read it and get as much value out of it as I did. If I had number two, it would be pretty much anything out of Simon Sinek over like the last few years. So Start With Why, Leaders Eat Last, The Infinite Game, like a big fan of his writing and his point of view.
I love those book recommendations, especially the Simon Sinek ones. Those are awesome. What is one app you cannot live without?
I mean, everybody's going to think I'm very basic for saying this, but I do have a bunch of guitars behind me. It would be Spotify, honestly. It's the app that I probably spend my most time on. And if it's not Spotify, then it's DoorDash. So really, if you need to like know anything about me, it's I need music and food to live. Otherwise, I'm good.
Okay. I'm so glad that you said Spotify. I feel like most people will say like, oh, they need, you know, Safari, or they need Google Maps, or, you know, something that's like more utilitarian. So I love that you shared something that you're passionate about. What do you think is the best invention of all time?
100% definitely the air fryer. It is the best invention ever made. If you were listening in right now, and you have not purchased an air fryer, or you're not sold on an air fryer, I will personally demo it for you. It has changed my life. There's not a meal in this house that is made without the air fryer being used. If it broke, I would leave my house immediately and I would go buy another one. I couldn't even wait for it to be delivered. I would have to go physically buy one and bring it back to the house.
I love it. So now we know you're a big foodie. You said breakfast tacos, DoorDash, and now air fryer. That's awesome.
Yes, it's coming out.
It's coming out. And what's your all-time favorite accomplishment?
Yeah, I've been married for 10 years, and I've been with my wife in a relationship for 12 years. And so I think that's probably one of my greatest accomplishments, honestly. I think it takes a lot of work. It takes a lot of communication. It takes a lot of empathy and care to be in a relationship with somebody that long. And so when I look back at the things I've done professionally or personally or whatever, the relationship that I have with my wife is probably one of my greatest.
Oh, that's really beautiful. And what's the biggest challenge you're working on right now?
So I am working very diligently with leadership and my VP of product at the company I work at called Order. And we're trying to build and scale a product and design team. We're trying to make various improvements to our product so that we can be more competitive, so we can get investments to help us get to a Series C. So there's a lot of huge challenges kind of rolled up into all those things that I said, where I'm at. And this is one of the first startups I've ever worked at least at this level. And so that is bringing all kinds of new and wonderful challenges and learnings and upskilling for me.
That's awesome. And so such a great segue into our conversation. You've been in design for the last 20 years and a design leader for most of that. So when scaling the team, what's that challenge been like for you? You said you've been hired to scale the creative and research team.
Yep. Yeah. So it is difficult to do both things I've found in my job, either inherit a team or scale a team from scratch, right? They both have different amounts of difficulties and challenges. But scaling really is, it's about trying to define early on, how do you want your team to, what do you want your team to be representative of? And what is most important for the budget that you have now, where the product is now, where the team is now, sort of the maturity of the company. And then what is your plan in those milestones to grow that at the right pace for how the product is growing and how the company is growing. So for me, my strategy and some of the challenges were, what were the skill sets and the personality types and the background that we needed out of the first few hires. And those are very, I think, very important pivotal decisions that you make when you're scaling a team, because they're eventually going to be your successors, right? They're going to be the leaders of that team. And so you want to find people you can invest in, that you can kind of help craft the culture and the way that product design is done, or design in general is done, so that when you are scaling and you're bringing people underneath them, that you have a really great foundation for those new folks.
Gotcha. So you mentioned that, there's a few different elements when it comes to scaling. You have the budget, and you're also looking at inheriting versus scaling the team. What would you say are some of the I guess nuances of scaling versus inheriting those teams?
Yeah. So I think one of the most obvious ones is when you're inheriting a team, you're coming in as a leader and you have to immediately try to earn their trust in the most genuine but the fastest way possible, because as soon as you start your job, no matter what job you have, you're under a time frame, right? Of how quickly you can deliver value and how quickly you can deliver positive change and make an impact. So, I found when you're inheriting a team, you have to decide on what your method of trust gathering and gaining is going to be, both for those people trusting you and you trusting them. How much autonomy do you want to give folks before you understand sort of where they're fitting within the organization, where their skill set is, and things like that. So it very much is a lot of coming in and being an observer and a researcher, but knowing kind of when to pivot into being a decision maker and setting really clear expectations to people and sort of setting the bar of expectation for how things are done and at the level of impact they should be done. Whereas you have a little bit more of a choice. And I'm not saying this is easier or better building a team from scratch, but you have a little bit more of a choice of how quickly you move towards those different things. When you're bringing people on, you really are choosing, and you get to be sometimes very picky about the folks who are joining. And you get to be a little bit more methodical about how they fit into the organization, what kind of projects they'd be working on, et cetera. So to sum that up, I think inheriting a team is really how do I fit in and how can I best fit in with these group of individuals and these humans, to how can I build something where other people can fit in. Two different mindsets, but ultimately it's the same goal, right? You just want to have a high performing team and you want everybody to feel really clear on what their expectations are. and you want to give them the autonomy that makes them feel really great about working with you.
Yeah, I think you summarized that really well. It's like, regardless of whether you're inheriting the team or you're building it, one, it's really important to set that expectation with your team, and two, that you're earning their trust. And I'm curious, like, you know, in both situations, like, how do you set that expectation so that they feel good about the vision and that the output that they're putting in is for the greater goal?
Well, I think I call it the two C's, the curiosity and clarity. So for me, it's how can I be super curious about what this individual wants out of their career? Why are they there? What gets them out of bed? What gets them excited? What do they not like? I'm really curious about the company and the needs of the design team. I'm curious about where I fit in, what's my role, what's like most important for me to be able to achieve, and what are the expectations of me and by proxy my team. And so through that curiosity, I'm then able to understand what people's expectations are of me, and I can start to formulate what strategy will work with the people that are I'm surrounded with, you know, the team that I have. And then the clarity comes in around the strategy expectations. How can I best communicate what the most important things that we do, right? Let's say I inherit some designers who are struggling in certain skill areas, right? Or maybe they're struggling at managing up, or they're not super clear communicators. I can set expectations around where I want them to be. And we can start building a plan with goals on how to get them there. And I can also find out, like, hey, what are some things that they didn't necessarily like, maybe about their previous manager? What kind of like unfortunate toxicity, which I've seen, you know, in the past, they've been dealing with, and how can I navigate those things so I understand what their expectations are of me? And we can make sure that's really clear, written, verbal, you know, and talked about ad nauseum, so we really are on the same page.
Gotcha. And you seem to have very specifics on how to set those expectations. And, you know, every great design leader has their different methods and techniques to get to that point. I'm curious what your journey has been as a design leader and manager to acquire the skills that you have now in leading your team.
Yeah. So is this more a question of kind of like where are my roots? Like, where did I come from, and kind of how did I find my way into leading instead of doing?
Yeah. Because I you know, you're as a in your career, you've been you started off as a designer, and a lot of times, you know, I see it as like two paths. Either you continue to stay as a designer and then you grow your skills as a design person, or, you know, the other second path is more down the route of product management, right? And I think you're somewhere in the middle between product management and refining your designs. So how did you, I guess, talk us through your career and how you got here.
Cool. Yeah. Well, so super young, I was a junior in high school, and I had this idea that I wanted to be a creative director. And specifically, I wanted to be a creative director for Google, and I wanted to one day slide down a fireman pole down to the cafe and eat free food, right? So I was totally enamored by this idea at that
food
time. Yeah, again with the food, I'm so hungry. I had this really great English teacher who recognized, you know, my path to wanting to become a designer professionally, and she was engaged to a creative director. And so I met this individual, and he showed me around the studio he was working at, and he introduced me to his best friend, who was the head of design for an industrial design company. And I got an internship as a junior in high school, which was a huge opportunity for me. And I got to see the product process there from a 360 degree view, everything on like what happens to a product. And just like put this in quick perspective, like let's say Fossil hired this company to design them watches, which was a thing that happened. And come up with an idea for a watch, and then we send it to the 3D guy, and he built it in CAD, and then he send it to the shop, which is on site, and then they build the watch, and then they send it back to us, and we package it and write a jingle for it and build a website for it and all this kind of stuff, and then sell it back to the client. So I really got to see how a product was made. And I was just floored by how cool of a gig that was. And but I was really most impressed by the kind of the strategy that it took for the person who was in charge to kind of get all the wheels in motion and make sure that like this creative process was headed in the right direction. So I went to art school. I got my BFA, and my first gig out of school was at American Airlines. I started on a UX team of three. This is back in 2011 when people were like, UX? UX team of three. When I left there to go work for Project 202, I was one of 33 people. So we expanded quickly at American Airlines, and the team grew, and I learned a lot through process. I learned a lot about Agile. I learned a lot about what it means to own a 50 by 100 pixel space on a website to, you know, being involved in like a major app. And so I started to build my confidence as a product designer. And then I joined Project 202, where they're an agency, they're a consultancy. And I found myself now all of a sudden, not only designing products, but I was in a room speaking to C-level executives and helping them understand kind of where, what we call in the design industry, triage, right? So, hey, how do we stop the bleeding? What's going on? And then how do we shift the conversation talking about like what the real problem is? You have a lot of symptoms. Let's solve these symptoms. And then if you come from agency, like, you know, this story, right? Like, let's solve what you're asking us to solve, but we all know there's something bigger here. Let's kind of figure out what that is. And I found myself really enjoying that process, but I was always much more interested in, what my creative director, the person I was reporting to, was doing, and kind of the responsibilities they had, the way that they would manage other designers. And again, I felt like I was getting pulled into this people management sort of route. Again, going back to like my original thought, I think I want to be a creative director, you know, like I don't know if this was natural or not, or me just like forcing this direction, but I wanted to do that. And so when I got the opportunity to become a creative director, I moved down here to Austin, and I started training under a great Mark Power Freeman, an amazing creative director at the time. And he started to kind of give me the rundown on like what it really means to be great at this job. And then when I took over the reins and started having people report to me, I had an existential crisis. You know, I didn't really know what to do with myself, or kind of, it was a mixture of what is my value, and now that I'm here at this destination, what do I do with this? This whole time I was thinking about how I wanted to be a creative director in this industry, and now I'm like, I don't build software anymore, and I don't, I'm not like individually responsible for being a maker. I'm responsible for the people who make the things. And I know I don't want to be the kind of boss that nobody likes, where I'm telling them what to do. So I had to quickly start to build some of the skill set to empower them to be creative and think strategically and not get bogged down in flurious details, or skill them up on like how to manage clients, or skill them up on how to take like different approaches at solving problems. But I know I didn't want to tell them how to do it. And meanwhile, like while I'm trying to like hone that in, I'm also thinking, if I'm not good at this, right, am I ever going to want to go back to being a builder, you know? And I think I put it to people this way before. I drew what I thought, like I drew a postcard of what I thought my destination was going to look like. And then when I got there, the postcard didn't look the same. You know, I hold it up to the environment. Yeah. I was like, this is very different than what I thought.
And yeah, as with life, right?
Yes, exactly. I mean, this is probably not a unique story to anyone, but I was given a book by the GM of the company, Turn the Ship Around, the one that I mentioned about earlier. And it really framed what it means to be a leader in a way where you're leading leaders. It's not leader follower, it's leader. And that really spoke to me. And that helped me build my my method around giving people the autonomy and the ability to make decisions in their area of influence, but setting the expectation that they're sharing their intentions early and often with me so that I can help direct, but I don't have to be in the details day to day. And the greatest point this book makes is that if you're a captain of a nuclear submarine, you can't be up 24/7. 7 days a week, controlling every little thing that ship is doing. You have to put belief into the people who are doing all the different things that makes a nuclear submarine run. And I really see, you know, any kind of leadership position being reflective of that.
I love that you brought the book back up. And it kind of circles back around what you mentioned earlier, which is building trust, right? So what you're saying is that you need to build that trust with your team, because you as a leader can't be expected to be doing everything, especially now that you're no longer a producer. You're leading leaders. That's such a hard job, because at what point do you let go, right? And I don't know if you have this problem. I certainly do, where I've been such a perfectionist all my life. And it's like, there's a vision of how I want certain things done. And then the toughest part is just letting go of that vision. Like, we're not, it's like, I see this, but I know I can't get there by myself. So I need to encompass other people and empower them. But the final results might be a little bit different. So what's your best advice on, one, building that trust and then letting go of what that final result is going to look like?
Yeah. Software is an incredibly hard medium for a creative person to be in because of how fluid it is. Basically speaking, when you are creating a website or a web app, the size of that person's screen, how big they have that screen, how the text falls on the screen, how much time they spend on it, what they click on, what they don't, you don't have any control over that, right? So already you have so much less control than your typical creative outlets. Like, for instance, music for me, like, you can go back in the studio, you can re-record, you can get that sound to be just perfect and dial it in before you release it to the world. As a creative, you're probably already unhappy with it when you do that, but somebody's pushed you to a deadline, you got to release it. But we'll talk about that another time. Or, if you're painting something, you can paint over and over and over until you get it, and you can kind of refine that final thing. Or if you're doing print design, the stakes are much higher because everything does need to be absolutely perfect before it goes to the printer. And then, there's hundreds of thousands of copies made. But in software, you also have this weird freedom. Even though you have lack of control in a lot of areas, you do have this freedom to make mistakes, to not have to get it right, and to iterate on it quickly. Be it, you're working for a type of company or in the environment that allows you to do so. And so for me, I was able to relinquish some of my control, knowing that we don't have to get it 100%. In fact, in product, it's a really bad stance to have. This has to be perfect before we release it. You're never going to release it. You're going to run out of money before, that feature makes it to the world, if you have that point of view. Yeah. So let's shoot for 80%, right? And 80% means...
What's that saying? It's like, done is better than perfect.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't let perfection get in the way of production. And so I truly feel like software is a place for you as a creative to learn how to relinquish some of that control and just let that go. And I think it's a healthier place for creative people because it comes from a place of rapid learning. I mean, what other industry can you release something and in days, hours, days, weeks, know if it's working or not, and then go in and tweak it? Especially if you're working for some of these big companies that have millions of users, you're getting data almost instantly.
Yeah, no, that's true. It's not like you can release a movie, get feedback from the audience, and then make tweaks to the film. So right. I think you make a good point that, it's an industry where it's a continuous iteration, and that in order to move forward, you're continuing to make improvements versus trying to get it done perfectly, because you're just going to run out of money in that. Let's switch over to, managing design teams and creatives. I want to stay to this topic because I find it to be extremely challenging personally to manage creatives. I'm including myself. I'm very tough to manage. we're completely different types of breed. We, if you tell us go do ABC, we're probably going to go think about, XYZ, 1, 2, 3, and circle it around and then come back to A, B, and C. Versus someone who's more operational and analytical that just, you tell us what to do, we'll go get it done, easy peasy. So what's that experience been like, and how do you get the best work out of creatives?
Right. So creative people are incredibly hard to manage, or they're not necessarily hard to manage. They're just very unique, and they're not like a lot of other people in the product industry or software industry. They can't just turn creativity on like a tap. It's something that I think comes at really any moment. I myself have had this happen, but I've also, you know, had creatives who reported to me where they'll be up at 2 a.m. or 3 a.m. because they can't sleep because they have an idea and they just can't get out of their head, or that creativity is hitting them and they need to do it. And so here they are working at 2 a.m. and they're not super excited about, you know, being on a 9 a.m. stand up, you know, or something like that. So there's things that you need to take into account with the personalities of the people who are in the creative industry and what really makes them tick. And I think what I've learned is that every creative needs constraints, but they don't want them. So the best way to manage that is if you give a moment of a feeling of zero constraints, just to experiment with the idea of anything is possible, and then bring the constraints in. I find that I get better work out of creative individuals, and those constraints are really important. But what a lot of creatives, at least in the business of a product or product designers, want is to understand, like, how is this good for the customer? How is this good for the business? And how is this good for, you know, like the betterment of this product in general? And research is great. It helps with that, you know? And so having that knowledge and understanding of what is really important to our customers, what's really important to our business. Those are kinds of constraints I'm talking about, because then you start drawing a box around what is possible and what the focus and the goal is. So again, you know, I've seen things like design sprints be super helpful in this, where there's a moment of like learning at the beginning and then kind of drawing out whatever you think might work and writing out like how might we statements to get all those fears out and turn those statements into something that are like opportunistic and then really starting to constrain these ideas down to something that's buildable. And so those are some tools that I've seen that have really been helpful for managing creatives.
Yeah, no, I definitely like those exercises. I think some of the challenges that like I've seen in working with creatives is, you know, as you mentioned, like sometimes they're up until 2 a.m., 3 a.m. and then, you know, they don't want to be at that 9 a.m. stand up. So like that drives certain managers crazy. It's like, why weren't you there at the 9 a.m. meeting? Or if you were there, you know, you're halfway sleeping or you had your camera turned off. So, you know, what are some of the, actually, let's share some like, not nightmare stories, but what are some of the off the beaten stories that you've had to manage in terms of working with creatives?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how much detail I want to go into in some of these, but I will tell you that a lot of people don't understand or don't realize until they become a manager. And I think especially people who manage creative folks, that they are also a kind of a therapist, and that there is a bit of a therapist job that comes into this. Because as much as we all try to say that, you know, my work life starts here and my personal life starts here, look, sometimes we're spending more time with our coworkers than we are our families. It's a sad thing, but, you know, sometimes that's the case, especially if you're in a big push to a big release or something's going on, or you happen to be in like a really crazy startup environment. You know, you could be communicating with these folks more, and your work life and your personal life start to blur a bit. But even if that isn't the case, there are things that happen in our personal life that just affect our mood and affect our ability to be creative in work. And sometimes I end up listening to those stories and kind of dissecting a little bit of that. And I always try to keep it super professional and like, okay, so like, what does that mean for like the goal of what we're trying to achieve, and like where the roadblocks are, where your struggles are? Like, do you feel like you're going through mud right now, and you're not really like sure about like the path that we're going, or your ability to improve, or your ability to understand, or are there some really hard personalities that you're dealing with? Like your PM just never worked with a designer before and doesn't understand you, or your engineer, you know, doesn't care about UX and just wants to do backend stuff, and you know, isn't producing your ideas to the specifications you want. Sometimes like these feelings of frustration that happen because of like those common work elements are really like part of a sometimes a deeper thing that's going on, and that comes out, you know. And I try to take that with as much care as I can. You know, we're all human and we're all going through some stuff. And if I've learned anything from the pandemic, it's hard to separate that sort of feelings of anxiety and trauma, you know, and not bring it to the workplace. You know, it's just a reality, I think, of the way that work is done nowadays.
Oh, yeah, of course, especially now that, you know, everyone's working from home or they're having a hybrid model. You know, you're in that environment, right? Whatever's happening in your personal life is going to come out to the laptop in front of you, to your colleagues. And the person that you're talking to, whether it's your manager or team member, does in part become a therapist slash team member. And I'm curious, you know, how do you separate that from your personal life when you can't leave? You're no longer in an office. You just have a laptop in front of you in your home. So how do you manage those different types of energies?
Yeah, I have a few tactics, and some of them I've learned along the way. I actually happen to live next door to a music therapist. He works with musicians, but he also uses music for therapy. And I've also had like a really great career coach. Shout out to Steve in England. And so I've learned a few different tactics of stuff to do. I think the first one that seems to be in every article and everybody's saying, but I can't really hit it home enough, is get away from the screen when you can. Go outside, go for a walk, walk with your dog, change your environment, change what your eyes are seeing, kind of change what your mind is thinking about. Even if you still feel like you're struggling to like detach this thing that you're thinking about, maybe it's you're an engineer and you're thinking about trying to solve this coding problem, you're a designer and you're trying to solve this design problem. Changing your environment can change the way you think, and trying to get away from the problem from a little bit will give you a little bit of a different perspective. There's been like lots of studies on like how we need time in order to think through complex problems. Like they've done studies on people, you know, they play video games and they go to bed, and when they wake up the next morning, they go right back on the video game and they do better than they did before. And it's because they had this like cycle to be able to think through all of these problems. And so good sleep, that's another one. You know, make sure you're getting enough sleep and don't cut that down. But I also learned some other things that are a little bit more meditation based. And so I learned like three different techniques of meditation that you can do fairly quickly. We're talking like 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes. The first one is closing your eyes, quieting your breath, and then rubbing your fingers together very, very lightly. And just really thinking about the ridges and thinking about like what that feels like. And then moving to your hands, slowly going back and forth. And you'll find, you do it for 5 minutes, you'll find that you have sort of rewired your brain there for a moment to think about something completely different. And I think the more and more you do that, the faster that works. And the faster you're able to kind of switch contexts quicker, or just release kind of whatever you were dealing with at that moment and prepare you to deal with the next thing. Even if that thing was stressful or you had anxiety about it, or, you know, even if you just want to calm yourself from an exciting moment. So that's a good one. You can do that. And you can do that on screen. You don't have to close your eyes, right? And there's other ones that I've used where you close your eyes, you're listening to things, and you're trying to listen to something that is as far away as possible, and then start listening to things as you get closer, and eventually that becomes your own breath. And the whole time while you're doing this, you're really bad at it. I'm awful at it. What happens is, these thoughts come in and you just label them and send them away, right? My dog is barking, just dog barking, send that away, and then refocus on where you are. And with just a minimal amount of practice, you'll see huge improvement. I think it's worked for me.
I love that. I mean, I think these are just basic mindfulness that people should be putting into their everyday practice. You know, a lot of times, not to get too all like existential and everything, but we're constantly chasing after a target in our lives, right? Whether it's wanting to be a creative director, as you mentioned before, or we want more success and we want to advance our career. And so we're constantly chasing, and we're in front of our computer creating our own anxiety, right? We've got to meet deadlines. I got to make this promotion. I got to do this. And those small techniques that you just mentioned, like, okay, just take a break, change your environment, get some sleep, and meditate. My gosh, those are so simple, but they're such game changers. Like, I can't emphasize it enough of the three things that you just mentioned.
Yeah. And as a creative, they're almost anti-goals to what you habitually or just naturally want to do. Like, I don't know about you, but when I was in art school, instead of getting sleep and working on my portfolio, I would drink a bunch of Red Bull and stay up all night and be totally unhappy with the work that I did, right?
Of course.
When I probably, like, you know, I was really pushing, like 5 hours of just pushing, and I'm on fumes where I could maybe gotten 5 hours of sleep, and then in an hour, like, figured it out.
Yeah.
And so I think there's a lot of things that we just naturally as creative driven people think is an anti-goal to us getting to like that end state. But really, I think slowing down, calming down, getting rest, being mindful, those refill that creative tank and allow you to see problems differently and come up with innovative ideas faster.
Yeah, 100%. And I think the other thing too that I've learned over the years is how much more you can get done by actually slowing down. Like, because as you mentioned, just having time to think creates so much more clarity. And then when you have clarity, you're able to better communicate with your team about what you want done. And when you have that clarity in the vision and you can communicate properly, now everybody's on board working towards that one single goal versus you by yourself just going crazy thinking like, how do I get this done? And so what I've learned over the years is slow down, take those breaks, and you actually get more done. It's complete opposite of what you think would happen. So, yeah.
I've learned a lot from my introvert designers that I've managed, because I don't consider myself an introvert. I think I'm less extrovert than I used to be. But my introvert designers used to say, I don't like these brainstorming sessions that we're in where we're trying to rapidly come up with ideas or solutions to a problem. When a problem was presented to them, and I'm thinking about one specifically, he would say, you know what, I will write you an email, or I will send you some sticky notes, or I will do something, but like, I don't brainstorm. That's not the way that I work. And as a new manager, I was like, kind of put off by that. I'm like, can't hang out in here with us while we like throw the ball around and come up with ideas on the fly. And he's like, that's not how I operate. He was profound. He had the best ideas. He was so eloquent in the way that he would communicate things, and his stuff was so much more baked than it was just like shooting off the hip for these other folks, that it really changed my mind. And it was a catalyst for me to learn more about introverts just in general. I read the book Quiet by Susan Cain, which I think is great. And it kind of helped me put into perspective these different personality types, and like, and definitely in the creative realm, there's different ways of approaching things. You can learn a lot from introvert people. That's for sure.
Yeah, man, that must have thrown you off guard a bit, because it's like, I don't brainstorm. It's like, what a boundary, right?
Yeah, for sure.
So what did you tell him?
I had to trust him. You know, I had to trust that he knew like his process, and, you know, I had no reason not to believe him. I hadn't worked with him for that long, but I had no reason not to give him the space, and he delivered, you know. And then from that point on, he always did. And it was just very, like I said, it was a profound change in the way that I thought about how we can solve problems. And it's changed a little bit about like looking at team dynamics, you know, how we're all not creative or innovative in the same way. And I think that kind of circles back to like the way you build teams. Like, you need to learn a little bit about what people's processes are, because we all have the same double diamond product design process that we all talk about. But like, some people have fundamentally different processes when it comes to how do you react to a problem? And then how do you begin to think about solving it? We all know that like, you start with research, and then, you know, you diverge and you find all these things that could happen, and then you converge on something that works. But like, there's detail in all of those like triggers and milestones, and when you make the decision to do those things and the activities that you do to do them. And I think everybody has, you know, as they get more senior and they kind of find their groove, they all have different ways of doing it.
Yeah. Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, we had one of the most like talented designers that we had on the team. Like he would just disappear. Like there were times where we were concerned, like, is he coming back to work? And he would just drop in on the 11th hour with so much knowledge, value, and just output. It was just kind of crazy. He disappears and comes back with gold. But yeah, every creative is so different.
Yeah. Yeah. And like that might work for some. And I've met other people who are very communicative and social, and they like to work in groups where there's a lot of different opinions and they want to workshop stuff out, and they're very, what I call design in public. You know, they want to do that. I'll be honest with you. I'm a little bit bigger of a fan of designing in public than going off in the dark and coming back, because that works until it doesn't, right? And then when it doesn't work, you don't have a lot of data to figure out like what went wrong. Like why did we spend that time going down that path that didn't necessarily work or didn't land? I think there's a balance, you know. Creatives definitely need their time to like put their headphones on, don't talk to me. I get that for sure. But I do think that to build trust in an organization, especially an organization that maybe has never worked with designers before, there's a lot of them out there. Design needs to be demystified, right? Like we need to make people understand that it's art and it's science. There's still very much an art component. There is science there. And if we design in public and we take people along for the ride, they begin to see that this is like, it's not mad scientists in a design room, you know, coming up with something. It's like, we have a process and we have a way about solving things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And how would you describe, like, how would you describe the type of creative that you are?
I would say I'm a little bit, I consider myself unique when it comes to being a creative. I mean, my background, I was always kind of the mindset that I gravitated towards design. I gravitated towards music. I had a really hard time struggling. I struggled with math. I struggled with English. And then when I was about 3 years old, I was diagnosed with dyslexia. Thank God my mom was an educator and she kind of saw the signs of this, and I got tested and diagnosed, and like, yeah, your son's dyslexic, and his brain works differently than like what we consider to be like common or normal. What that meant was it took me longer to solve math. It took me longer to master English. I use both sides of my brain equally when I'm doing those things. So I also got super fatigued and I just would get frustrated because I get tired. But I was able to solve problems and puzzles quickly. Obviously, I was good at, you know, drawing and illustration. I had a good grasp of like color theory, and I just was naturally falling into this like creative mindset. And so I've always had that upper hand with like people who weren't like me, because one thing I was good at as well was communicating. And I think I had to really hone my communication skills in, because I thought differently than people and I couldn't do it writing. I had to do it verbally. So I got really good at storytelling and using visuals to kind of craft what I was trying to say. I think, you know, this is maybe even like a survival mechanism for me as I was a younger child, you know, growing up to being adolescent. So, you know, as I got into the workplace, or, you know, like later in school, and I was able to, you know, really lean on like that skill of communicating through story, communicating through visuals. And I found that like, I was able to communicate really well. Like people were like always told me like, man, that was so clear. Like I didn't understand this before or whatever. And I would find myself sometimes like explaining what the teacher was talking about to somebody who wouldn't understand. Maybe they're ADHD, maybe they're dyslexic, maybe they're also struggling with like this subject like I was at the time. And so, you know, what kind of designer am I? I think I'm kind of in the middle of somebody who needs to be organized and needs to have structure and needs like a clear understanding of like the problem is. But I also need that room to explore, and that room to sort of experiment and try things without the fear of failing. And there's probably a lot of people who are listening right now are like, yeah, that's kind of everybody. But I mean, I think that's kind of the groove that I fall into. And it's interesting. I've begun to notice that a lot of the creatives that I've worked with, either managed directly or worked alongside, come from some kind of learning difference like that. They either have ADD, ADHD, dyslexia, you know, something that makes them a little bit different than the accounting team, or, you know, the people who are, you know, doing things that wouldn't necessarily be seen as like a creative function.
But you make it sound like it's almost like a superpower, right? You were sharing how you've become, or you've learned to become, such a great storyteller. And I think being a great product leader, it's literally about storytelling. It's, you know, what's that vision, and then how do you communicate that with your team? So to me, it sounds like what you have is a superpower.
It's been a long time since I've seen dyslexia as something that was holding me back. There was a point in my life where it felt like it was like, why can't I just be, you know, like everyone else? Why can't I be super fast at mathematics? You know, I had to take programming in college, and it was rough. You know, syntax was hard. The thinking logically around like function loops and things like that, I was just like, oh my God, this is not for me at all. But you put me in front of, you know, motion graphics programs and things, I figured that out in a second. And, you know, now that I'm in the career that I'm in, I wouldn't take away being dyslexic for the world. I feel like I've 100% leaned into it. And yeah, it was something that, you know, a lot of educators I had in the past said that it's going to be really hard for him to overcome this. This is going to really set him back from the rest of the group. I think it shot me up.
That's amazing. Yeah, that's amazing. And so for any listeners who are in the creative field and they might have dyslexia or ADHD, like, what are some techniques or advice that you have for them to use what they have as a superpower to excel to the next level of their career?
Yeah, I think first is love yourself and don't fight it. You know, there was a time in my life where I was, you know, I get super frustrated about something, and I would mentally talk to myself in like not the greatest way. And I would never do that to like a 6-year-old that was trying to learn a skill, or even one of my designers that were trying to get better at something. So like, show that same kindness to yourself. You know, that was a big one for me to learn. And also reframe what you think success is in the realm of what you're naturally good at. Something that was told to me that really hit home is that we all have natural peaks and valleys, right? Things that we're really good at, that sometimes we're better than other people in the room at. And there's some things that we're not good at that other people are better than us at. Your time is better well spent really sharpening those things that you're already naturally good at than trying to learn a skill that you are below average at, right? All teams, if crafted correctly, will fill itself out with those folks who fill those gaps, right? Because you're not awesome at this one thing, pair yourself with somebody who is, you know, find that company that needs your skill that you're already really good at, and continue to just work towards being the best. And what's great is ADD, ADHD, dyslexia, whatever you might have, whatever has changed the way your brain functions, that is giving you that edge. It really is. And if you focus on those things, you know, you'll succeed. I truly believe it.
Yeah. Oh man. There's so much to dive into just the two things that you've mentioned right now. The first thing, which is like how you talk to yourself, that inner dialogue. Like, I could literally have an entire podcast, not just podcast episode, podcast about like mindfulness and that inner dialogue, because that has, for me personally, changed my life. I read this book, I think it was from Untethered Soul, where the author talks about like observing your thoughts as if your thought was a best friend. So if the best friend was telling you all the things that you're telling yourself in your head, is that really a good friend that you want to have around? Me personally, I was like, I really don't like this best friend. It's a lot of negative talk. It's a lot of like doubts and, you know, things I can't do. But I want my best friend to tell me, to be my biggest cheerleader and tell me all these great things. And I wasn't doing that. And it wasn't until I made that observation and said, okay, I'm going to change how I think and talk to myself, that literally my life completely changed. And I don't know if that's been your experience as well.
It's changing. You know, I think I'm going to have a constant battle with trying to be the best friend that I can be to myself. There were times in my life as I was growing up where I was told by people with power that like, you're not going to be able to do this, or you can't do this. And that, you know, I think makes an influence on you when you're younger, and it's hard to shed away some of those things when you're older. And it is probably until the day I die, it's going to be a constant thing that I'm working on. But I think what I try to do is set reasonable expectations. I think this is another great thing to tell, you know, highly driven individuals who might have, you know, a difference than others or might feel different than others, is don't set goals that are so like, don't go climb Mount Everest. Get to base camp one. Get to base camp one.
Yeah.
Take a nap. Go to base camp two. Take a nap. You know, hang out there for a while. Enjoy it, you know. And and so for me, it's, you know, if I slip up or if I find myself like getting down about something or myself, I just remember that like, I don't have to do that tomorrow, you know, and I don't have to do that for the next hour. And maybe if I want to hang out here in this shitty mood for a second, maybe I do that. And then I really kind of put a timer on it and say, I'm not going to do that in the next like 5 minutes. I'm going to go change that. And I use some of those methods that I was talking about. Go for a walk, change your perspective, rub your fingers together, think about the sounds around you. You know, there's a lot of different tricks there you can do to kind of remind yourself to be kinder to yourself.
Yeah. And you actually just reminded me about like the setting timing as well. Like, you know, if you're having a brain fog or a creative block, or you're feeling depressed or whatever it is, like one thing that's helped me is setting a timer. And this goes with decision making too. It's like, I'm just stuck. I put a timer and I, you know, time myself anywhere between 5 minutes to an hour, however long I need. And I say, for this time, I'm just going to either do nothing, or I'm going to make a decision by the end of this hour, or I'm going to allow myself to feel depressed for this hour and just cry. And then once that alarm goes off, then, you know, back to being a boss babe, got to like hustle and, you know, do what I need to do. But yeah, just allocating some time and in a systematic way has really helped me.
It can get away from you if you don't, you know, time is finite. Yeah. It's the thing we will never have enough of. So, yeah.
Oh yeah.
Set the timer and change your mind as quick as you can.
Yeah, for sure. And the other thing that you mentioned too, when you were providing advice, was, you know, focusing on like where you can hone in on your skills. I think that's so important. Another book that I'm going to bring up, it's called Hard Things About Hard Things by Ben Horowitz. And one of the things that he mentions in the book is that when you're hiring for leaders in your organization, don't necessarily look for lack of weaknesses in a leader, but rather what they're really good at and where they can add value. So it's more about focusing on the, you know, the positive traits about a person. And that also goes with just life in general, right? Like if you're constantly focusing on what you lack and what you don't have, or the negative things, then it's always going to feel like things aren't going your way. But if you hone in on the skills that you have and look at the positive things, the value that you're bringing into any situation, you're going to start to notice that you have so much more value to bring to the table. So I just wanted to bring that up as well.
Love it.
Yeah. Cool. Well, so that wraps up our time. Is there anything else that you'd like to share with the audience before we close out?
Millions of things, but we don't have the time for that. But I do want to just say thanks for having me on and listening to my ideas and my opinions. And again, like those are my ideas and those are my opinions, and they might work for you and they might not work for you, or you might have felt some sort of connection to the stuff that I was saying or not. And that's totally okay. You know, we're all kind of on our own path. And, you know, it's, I really just want to hit home, like, what works for some people might not work for others. And it's find your own groove and find your own way of managing folks. Just do it with trust, love, and respect and empathy, and it'll work out.
I love that. I love that closing note. Mike, if somebody wants to get in touch with you or, you know, hit you up for design advice, what's the best way to reach you?
Yeah. Well, you can go to my website, miketownsend.com. You can email me at mike@miketownsend.com. You can hit me up on LinkedIn. It's LinkedIn/in/Mike Townsend. And I am pretty quick to respond. So yeah, if you have any questions or whatever, I'd love to hear from you.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Mike. We loved having you on the show.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.